For the week of April 2nd, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 361, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York City, I'm Michael Giltz.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt your breakfast or your lunch or what's going on?
I'm eating some ribs because you know this is going to be a long show. You were gone for a week. There will be an intermission. And during intermission, please go to the lobby, enjoy some soda or some jujubes. That is where we make our money, you know. It isn't on the admission price. So please, you know, do patronize the concession stand. But yeah, it's going to be a long show because you were at CinemaCon last week. There may not even be a show next week because you're going to be in New York.
That's true. We're trying to figure out whether we do the show together, which would be, I don't think we've done that in years.
Not since Con. It would be more of a Punch and Judy type show where I say something and you hit me on the head and you say something, then I hit you with a bat, that sort of thing.
Okay, I'm going to go YouTube Punch and Judy so that I know what you're talking about.
Really? You don't know Punch and Judy?
I do, but I thought it would be funnier if I didn't.
Okay. Well, yeah, so we got a big show this week because of CinemaCon. I'm still on Showbiz Sandbox because somehow I was not selected by the New York Times to be their lead theater critic. I don't know how that happened, but it was Jesse Green from New York Magazine, which is great because, as I believe I said on the show, certainly in life, if I was going to hire someone, it would have been Jesse Green if they weren't going to hire me, because I thought he was the best critic around. So that's great. And it's kind of a double F you to Charles Isherwood because they hired Jesse Green and they made him the official co-lead theater critic, which is exactly what Isherwood, some people say, was one of his many complaints. So, and he's headed to an email newsletter. That's the world we live in. He's now going to review movies for Broadway Briefing, which is a great theatrical daily newsletter about news in the industry that also has a website now. And Isherwood is going to be posting reviews on that website along with another critic, a woman whose name escapes me because I'm a sexist jerk. And Sperling is staying with the show because he's not going to go run Disney because Robert Iger got a one-year extension. He's going to stay there. He swears to July 2019. Then he's really, really going to retire.
This time, I mean it, is what he said. Yeah.
That's right. So they'll all be in the business. They'll all be working and they'll all want to know what's happening in the world of entertainment. And they're going to listen to our show. If they listen this week, what will Jesse Green and Robert Iger be learning about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we'll talk about CinemaCon. As you mentioned, Michael, I'm back from the annual confab in Las Vegas and we've got annual box office figures, the end of movie screens and movie projectors and China, the way most people pronounce it, and much more to discuss. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about the second American Civil War, and that's right, you heard me correctly. On Inside Baseball, we'll talk about the looming writer's strike. It's definitely coming, at least we think so. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we start. Then we also pull info from Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profit. And the number one movie around the world is Beauty and the Beast, $114 million over the weekend, $875 million worldwide. Here's how much people are starting to really talk about worldwide box office. The waiter from Mexico at my local diner said, yeah, the movie's made, you know, like $800 million worldwide now already after just a few weeks. <It's> like, we'd never discussed movies before, and suddenly he's talking about the worldwide box office of Beauty and the Beast.
I just think it's funny that, like, you're like, here's my anecdotal evidence. It must be true.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's true. It started in the early 80s. Newspapers started to run box office top five, and they never did that before. Suddenly, box office became a thing, and then it became a marketing tool, and then it became a way of covering the industry, and it gained more and more credence and was something that was in the popular world, not just people in the industry talking about it. And now you're seeing that happen with worldwide box office, and again, it becomes a marketing tool where you say, oh my gosh, it's made so much money, I want to see it. So it's, you know, Hollywood has found value in letting the world know what their movies have made. Though sometimes when the writers and the actors come a-calling, they wish they didn't know how much movies were making money around the world.
That's true.
That's right. So that's the number one movie around the world. It's going to hit $1 billion. How many movies have made $1 billion worldwide? Like 30, 40? I mean, we're going to have another three or four this year.
I think it might be up to 25 to or 30 now.
Yeah, it's we take it for granted, but that's how amazing that is. At number two around the world is The Boss Baby. And no, it's not a political statement. It's an animated film, a final success story practically from DreamWorks. animation, $85 million the weekend, $108 million worldwide. So it has opened up in a couple extra territories. And number three is Ghost in the Shell, the Scarlett Johansson vehicle, $60 million over the weekend, and that's what it's made worldwide. A film that they want to explain why it didn't do well at the box office by pointing to all sorts of ancillary reasons rather than just the fact that it's not a very good movie.
To answer your previous question, in 2014, there were 19 movies that had billion-dollar box offices around the world. Now, that was 2014. Just three short years later, there are 28 movies that have grossed $1 billion worldwide.
So it's a 50% increase in 3 years from all of history. And we're going to see, we'll be to 40 in the blink of an eye. It really is a whole new level. I remember the days when $100 million was a lot of money.
Right.
Ooh, and that's a blockbuster.
As a matter of fact, at CinemaCon every year, they have the $100 million reel, which was the reel of films. You know, it was kind of a big sizzle reel for those movies that had passed the $100 million mark. And at this point, it's like 30 minutes long. Because
they haven't updated it yet?
I think that they should update it to at least 200 million.
Oh, God, yes.
But,
You
know, it's a celebration of the movie, so they kind of
they're happy to make it go on and on.
Right.
Yeah, but when movies gross $100 million on opening weekend, not so exciting. At number four around the world is Kong, Skull Island, $43 million over the weekend, $480 million worldwide, and that's a pretty important number because that means they pretty much tripled their budget. So that is a success story for Warner Brothers. At number five is Power Rangers, the reboot of that long-running franchise, $22 million over the weekend, $100 million worldwide. I don't know if reboot's quite the right word. They've never really succeeded as a film, and they're looking to make that happen now, and they're on their way. At number six around the world is The Devotion of Suspect X. And if that name sounds familiar, it should. It's a Chinese mystery. It grossed $22 million on its opening weekend, but that's where the mystery begins. This movie is a crime drama, and it's a remake of the 2012 Korean crime drama, which was itself a remake of the hugely popular Japanese film of the same name from 2008, also a crime drama. That was a spinoff from the TV series called Galileo, and that was inspired by the best-selling mystery series by Kaigo Higashino. And they've had four novels, four collections of short stories in the Detective Galileo series. It's about a detective whose best friend, a physicist, helps him figure out crazy, hard-to-solve mysteries, and they work together to do it. And there's a U.S. shingle called Cross Pictures, which I've never heard of. They had the English language rights to this movie in this particular book, and I assume the series. They've had it since 2011. What's keeping them? Come on, people. Everybody else has remade this movie. Come on. Pick up the slack.
Maybe they just want to see what all the good ideas are from around the world and then just put them all into one movie.
Right, which makes me want to jump down to number 24 on our list, which is a movie called Three Idiotas. It's a Mexican coming-of-age film. It grossed $1.7 million on its opening weekend, so it's way down towards the bottom of the list. I'm not sure what the budget is, but it's about three guys from college who reunite 10 years later to try to track down their friend/rival who disappeared on the day of graduation. This began as a Bollywood film that was the biggest Bollywood film hit ever in international markets back in 2009. It made more money overseas than any other Bollywood film in history. It was remade in Tamil in 2012. Stephen Chow is working on a Chinese remake. The U.S. is apparently working on a remake. It was even remade in Telugu, which is a particular ethnic area of India. And it had been dubbed into that language and shown there, but they still wanted to remake it again in that language for real. So this is movies today. Properties happen from TV or film. They get remade and sometimes they play all over the world. And sometimes, even if they do, they want to remake them again with the local flavor. So that brings me back to Ghost in the Shell. Is that movie an example of whitewashing, of an actress who should have played a Japanese character? Or is it just, hey, they took a property and made it for their own audience?
I think they took a property, made it for their own audience, and didn't move far enough away from the original, so it turned out to look like whitewashing. How's that for an answer?
That's a good answer. It is frustrating. There are terrifically talented actresses who are English speaking or are American or whatever. Actresses who are Japanese would have been great in that role, who could have done it and killed it. And you can certainly say, hey, there are so few roles that seem intrinsically for them that why take it away from them when why not give some great talented actress a chance? On the I think it applies more to, say, Mulan. It's set in China. You can't have an American play that character in China. We don't do that anymore the way you used to have British actors play Nazis. But Ghost in the Shell repurposed to a different part of the world or played as a different character. She's not playing a Japanese character. She's playing a character that's been rewritten completely. So I understand their frustration. But when you look at how many movies are remade all the time, it does give you a certain different perspective on how that happens. It's just when it's Hollywood, they're so much bigger than everybody else. It kind of smashes everything else and you ignore all that. But it's an interesting to look at. And number seven around the world is Smurfs, The Lost Village. $15 million on its opening weekend overseas. We'll have to see how it plays out. Oh, wait, did it open here? No.
No, it didn't open here. I believe it opened overseas.
32 territories this movie opened up in. We'll have to see if it gets any good word of mouth. And number eight, a movie that is not getting good word of mouth, is Life with Jake Gyllenhaal, who's triumphing. Believe me, that's the word on Broadway in Sunday in the Park with George. This movie's doing okay. $12 million over the weekend, $51 million worldwide. And number nine is Logan, the last chapter for Wolverine, at least with Hugh Jackman in the role. $11 million over the weekend, just under $600 million worldwide. That's probably where it'll get by next weekend. And number 10 is Extraordinary Mission. $8 million on its opening weekend, and it's extraordinary, but I have no idea what this movie is or what territory it comes from. I couldn't figure it out.
I don't know. That's a good question.
If they know, they should contact us, shouldn't they, Sperling?
Yes, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also reach out to us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up, and we do respond to people who post messages there.
We love it, don't we?
We absolutely do.
That brings us to our next movie, which is Get Out, which made $8 million this weekend. And let's point out again that that would be a fine opening weekend in North America. And yet it's like 6 weeks into its run. It's made $170 million worldwide. It's a massive, massive hit. And it's making money and it's got good legs. And yet we're already finding out when it's coming out on DVD and on demand, aren't we? Yes, we are. Yeah, when you're in the industry, I've already gotten emails offering, say, do you want to have a copy of this on Blu-ray or DVD? This is when it comes out on demand. This is when it comes out on DVD. Let us know. And yet they think, to me, it seems like it's happening right away, but Hollywood is convinced that it needs to happen quicker, and they're going to make that happen. For example, it's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray May 23rd. That's the schedule date, which means it comes out a few weeks earlier, probably in early May. So we're talking in 4 weeks from now, this movie, which is still playing theaters, is going to be available on demand.
Right.
And Hollywood is convinced that's not happening fast enough, even for big hits like this, right? We're not talking about the flops. We're talking about all movies that they want to have a quicker window. And we're going to talk a lot more about that come our CinemaCon section, aren't we?
That's right. I like the way you're teasing that, by the way.
That's right. And number 12 is The Missing, $6 million on its opening weekend. 13 is Chips, which is not doing well. Sing, on the other hand, is doing quite well. That passed the $610 million mark worldwide. So that's the American Idol / animated flick that's doing just great. That's from Universal. And at number 15, here's one of our other our final big movie I want to talk about. It is called The Prison. It's a Korean drama about an ex-cop sent to prison for hit and run who discovers that the prison is controlled by one inmate who has the guards and the warden all on the take. And he's not only controls the prison, but he's got a crime syndicate out in the world, but he has the perfect alibi. He's in prison. What are you going to do? Throw him in prison? So I thought that was a really fun concept. It made $4.6 million this weekend. It's at $14 million and counting. But if anything's right for a Hollywood remake, this sounds like it. And it's the directorial debut, I apologize for messing up your name, Na Hyun, who has penned a string of light romantic comedies and animated fare. This looks like the first drama of any sort that he's been involved with. And he not only wrote it, but he also directed it. So a breakthrough for him and a funny concept that – funny. It's a serious film. A fun concept that could work for Hollywood.
Well, and I probably stand mistaken. I believe that the CinemaCon $100 million reel is now, I think, the top 20 or 25 films in the world.
It just felt like it ran a long time because there were so many cool movies.
Exactly, yes.
Well, all right. So that brings us to a global box office, doesn't it? There was a look at global box office. It grossed a record $38.6 billion.
That's right.
And And you got to look at the exchange rates, of course. When you put it into dollar terms, you could have an increase in ticket sales and you could have a decrease in box office just because of the exchange rate. So you got to look at all the different territories and what's going on there. Ticket sales in China actually fell.
That's right.
So that's very telling. Box office fell to $6.6 billion in 2016 after increasing 50% the year before. So it increased by 50% in 2015 and then it actually dropped in 2016, box office and ticket sales. It actually grew in terms of local currency, but they're paying more for their tickets because of the whole collapse of the subsidized ticket market that they were having in China. So it's a very complicated thing. You got the subsidized tickets, you got the currency exchange rate, but when you step back and look at China, you can see box office fell and ticket sales fell, and that's not a good recipe.
Right. Now, just to explain what subsidized tickets are, basically, all these mobile ticketing apps were buying the tickets for movies and then selling them to customers at cheaper prices. So
they could get market share. So they could eventually be the only player and then you start to make more money. So they were willing to lose sales, just like Best Buy would lose sales on DVDs to get you into their store and buy a refrigerator. Or in this place, they wanted to do your name and your email so that you would go to them when you bought a ticket, and then eventually they'd make money on it.
Well, the eventually was this year. They stopped subsidizing and because they were losing so much money. And so then people started seeing fewer movies because the ticket prices were so high.
But are they actually profitable now, these third-party apps?
We don't know yet. That's the question. Now,
so looking at more box office internationally, box office was down in China, Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, all around about 2%. So it was a modest dip in box office. Latin America is where it really fell hard, 17% drop, especially in Venezuela, which is obviously a country that is in serious trouble in so many different ways. But North America, there's a bright spot, $11.4 billion in North America, a 2% increase. Admissions, however, were flat at $1.32 billion.
Right. Now, so a couple things. One, Latin America, the issue there is, once again, currency. And as you mentioned, Venezuela, movies for someone like you or I with an American dollar, they're effectively 20 cents. They're practically free. There's no money. They can't get the money in. They can't get the money out. The reason that studios continue to release movies in Venezuela is because they do not want the habit of movie going to die. Okay. So that is really what they're doing there. But Brazil, the currency kind of fell. And in Europe, the same thing, except for in Germany, where there was a big box office dip and big attendance dip. All of the dip in Europe is due to the stronger U.S. dollar. And since everybody's measuring the worldwide box office in U.S. dollars to keep it the same from year to year, because the dollar is stronger this year, it makes it seem as if less money was earned in, say, the United Kingdom, where
admissions okay?
Admissions were okay, except in Germany, where there was an issue.
So, and looking at India, that's a market that's also doing well for Hollywood. Hollywood revenue is rising in India. The top 10 Hollywood films grossed $108 million in 2016. So that's great. It's rising. It's doing better. But when all the biggest Hollywood movies together only bring you $108 million, you can see a lot of room for growth, isn't there?
Well, a lot of room for growth where?
In India.
In India, absolutely, yes. And, look, they've already gone through their multiplexing, so there are multiplexes throughout most of the country at this point. But again, the content is mostly local, which is good. When you think about it,
90% of the market is dominated by locally generated content. So Hollywood is like, that's great, but we wish ours was a little higher, like 40%.
Right. I'm sorry, go ahead.
India was a $2 billion market last year, $2.1 billion, and Hollywood gets about 10% of that, of the total market. So they pulled out $200 million from India. And currency is throwing all of this off a little bit. There have been currency reforms or a fight against black market or however you want to characterize this step by Modi in India. And that caused the last 2 months of box office to drop precipitously, 20 to 25%. So, there's a lot of asterisks about what's going to happen for this year because of that currency issue.
Yeah. And again, so ultimately when you look at the statistics that the Motion Picture Association of America put out, the increase, $11.4 billion in the U.S., was in North America. The decrease, if you want to call it that, was internationally, where it was $27.2 billion, down from $27.3 billion, so barely down, and so therefore we can kind of point to the currency issues. International box office is 71% of the gross of worldwide box office.
Wow. And 3D has unquestionably stalled in many ways. I think that's if you're looking at North America, but I don't know about worldwide.
Yeah, I don't know either. I will say this, that one little tiny tidbit that I caught my eye, 11% of moviegoers who go once per month. Okay, so that's a frequent moviegoer. They buy tickets once a month. They go to the cinema once a month, so they go 12 times a year. 11% in North America of those customers account for 48% of tickets sold.
And that's probably normal, I would think. I would think most, you know, there are people who are avid music buyers, and in the old days, they would buy an album every week, all right. The time. They'd go buy albums. Most people buy one or two albums a year. If people go to a movie for, I mean, that's really frequent, right? I mean, if people go to three or four movies a year, Hollywood's thrilled, right?
I think the average now is four in the U.S. I'm pretty sure.
I don't think that's the average that they go. Most people go once every 3 months. I think that's a little high even. But it is true that 236 million people went to at least one movie last year in North America. So that leaves another 100 million people they can reach out to.
Yeah, it's about 3.8.
And most of them are women.
Yes,
52% of all ticket sales are to women. Three of the five biggest movies of the year in North America sold most tickets, as you would expect, since they're the biggest part of the market, to women. Finding Dory, The Jungle Book, and Sing. The big growth in Black and Asian movie going. Hispanic and Latino growth slowed a bit, but they were always punching above their weight in recent years, so that's nothing to be too concerned about. It's a natural slowdown in a market that had been really growing a lot. And the six major studios released 133 films, about three a week.
Is a remarkable number, even though that is fewer than they used to release.
And back in the 40s and 30s, obviously. But,
well, I mean, even like 10 years ago when they were each, kind of releasing 20 movies a year. And now you've got some studios saying, like Paramount, hey, we've got four movies this year.
And the MPAA says 4 out of 10 movies make money. So 60% of all films lose money.
Right. Which is, remember who the MPAA works for. Okay. Keep that in mind. Mm-hmm. They work for the studios.
Do you mean they don't make money out of the bat off box office? Is that what you're saying there, buddy?
Yeah, I think what I mean by that is Chris Dodd and the Motion Picture Association of America, Chris Dodd being the head of it, work for the studios. So when you're trying to negotiate your contracts and you're trying to pay creatives less money, one way to do that is to cry poor. And that's, I think, a little bit of what you're seeing there. That's not to say that, that's not close to the truth. Theatrically,
that's a different issue, though. Yeah, that's not the game. It's not theatrically because you've got worldwide box office, not just North America, and you've got all these other revenue streams. But speaking of the MPA, one of their bosses is new, right? Because they work for the studios, and the head of Paramount looks like it's going to be Jim Giannopoulos.
That's true. Jim Giannopoulos, we've talked about him a lot here on this show within the past year because, of course, he was the head of 20th Century Fox for decades. And he was kind of summarily shown the door when Stacy Snyder said, hey, you hired me to be the head of the studio, but you still got this Jim Giannopoulos guy. When do I take over? And a lot of people were wondering, gee, does she go? Because there's really no need to have her there. And eventually the Murdoch brother said, all right, Jim, I think he's in his 70s or 60s. Hey, it's time for you to retire. We're going to put Stacy in charge. Jim said, yeah, I'll leave, but I'm not exactly in the retiring frame of mind. I'm going to head on over to Paramount. I hear they have not only an opening, but they're in a little bit of trouble.
So the big issue was Greenlight, and what happened there? I'll tell you that like most other studios, there will be a committee overseeing big budget greenlighting, but he got the right to greenlight movies with budgets of $100 million or less.
Right.
That's what we understand will be happening, which is fine, right? That's where you want to have your creative input anyway.
Well, and the question then becomes, how many movies are you making for under $100 million these days?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, I honestly don't know the answer to that, but I do know that Mission Impossible.
How many is he allowed to greenlight?
Right. I think when you look at some of the movies they're making, maybe for instance, Baywatch. That was under $100 million, and I have to say, You know, at CinemaCon, they do all of these studio presentations, the studio reels. They're either sizzle reels or they basically show theater owners, movie theater owners, what they will be releasing over the next 12 months, let's say, or at least through the end of the year. And I thought, why am I going to go to this Paramount, you know, presentation? It's going to be like four movies. One of them is going to be Transformers, and I don't even know what the other ones are going to be. Well, one of them was Baywatch, and The Rock and Zac Efron came out. They actually did a really funny presentation, and it was one of the better presentations, even though there were like two or three movies that they had to show.
Well, they got to make a show because they don't have a lot of movies.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I was wondering, is somebody like, you know, whispering in The Rock's ear, well, Dwayne Johnson's ear, hey, stall, stretch it.
So he got a bachelor's degree in 1973 from Boston University. So I'm going to guess he was probably about 22 at the most.
Right.
And then he went on to get a law degree. So 73, so he's probably about mid, late 60s.
Right, which is, yeah, okay. And we're talking about Jim Giannopoulos, not Dwayne Johnson.
That's right. So we're at CinemaCon, aren't we? You're at CinemaCon, and there's a lot of happening. Was the mood exuberant? Was it worried? Was it, what was going on?
Well, okay. I guess since we started off talking about Paramount, why don't we hit the studios first, and then we'll backtrack. How about that?
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, basically these studios, they do their presentations in the Coliseum. It's where Rod Stewart performs, Elton John, Celine Dion. It's a big 2,500-seat auditorium, maybe even more. Three levels, and you know, it was packed every single presentation. If you did not get there early, you did not get a seat. It was kind of annoying. And for the most part,
why don't they have a bigger venue?
Well, there aren't any. I mean, think about it.
The 2,500 seats, that's not very big.
Right, but you're holding the conference at Caesar's Palace, which is where the conference is held. And you don't want to go down the street, or you can't find any, you know, think about it. That's
the biggest venue Caesar's Palace has.
Right. And you don't want to be shipping people all over the place because it would just take too much time. So it's big enough, barely. And you know, the first presentation with Sony, it was okay. You know, of course they showed the Spider-Man and a few films that they're showing. I would call out a couple of things. Some studios get up there and all they do is they just run down one film after another. They just say, okay, then on March 15th we have, and they just show the trailer. That was Lionsgate, okay? They didn't really do much. Then there was Disney, and everybody, it was a big Wednesday night presentation. Everybody wanted to see it because, of course, you know, it's Disney. They got all the big movies. They made $7 billion worldwide last year. And Dave Hollis comes out. Nice guy, love the guy, international head of distribution, and he stands on stage for 15 minutes, and he talks about all of the movies, one after the other, and when they're going to be released, and he's putting them up on a little timeline, and that's it. He does not show a frame of film. He then,
because they don't need to?
I think there's a couple points there. One, they probably don't need to. Two, they're really, really stressed out about piracy. They don't want to show anything. Even when I go to Expo Cine, they check you have to put your phone in a bag and you get it back at the end of the presentation. They don't want anybody pirating that stuff. And 3,000 people is really hard to control whether somebody's using their phone to videotape something. So that said, people were a little, you know, were scratching their heads. They then showed Pirates of the Caribbean 5 or whatever they're up to now. The other big presentation, there were two others. Warner Brothers, they showed some footage from Dunkirk, which was shown previously in front of, it was the IMAX presentation in front of Rogue One. I couldn't remember the film they showed it in front of. And people kind of were, you know, lukewarm on that. The presentation that may not have been, you know, the greatest films of all time, but got the best response was 20th Century Fox. They invited Goldie Hawn and Amy Schumer to come out and address the audience for their movie Snatched. They showed some of the DreamWorks animation films that they had. I think they have one more coming. And then they brought out Hugh Jackman, and he's standing in the center of the stage. Now, mind you, this was after they started their presentation with this dance troupe in pitch blackness with laser light suits in choreographed to, you know, within centimeter. It was unbelievable. And it was definitely one of those moments where you go, okay, this is the way a studio should present their reel. But when Hugh Jackman came out, he told all of these wonderful stories, and he said, I know I'm going on too long, but he was there to present The Greatest Showman, which is the P.T. Barnum biopic. And he did such a great job, and the footage looked so good.
And this is a musical.
It's a musical. And he talked about how Zendaya wound up in the role, and she plays the bearded lady in the musical, and how when he first came to CinemaCon, he was standing in between Sylvester Stallone and Clint Eastwood, and he was just beside him, so he couldn't believe it. And you know, he kind of turned to Clint Eastwood and said, "Oh, I'm such a big fan." And Clint Eastwood just looked at him and said, "Hey, kid, you're holding up the line." And I mean, I guess you had to be there for it, but it was a nice presentation. Ended with a whole chorus full of people singing the songs from the movie and balloons falling from the ceiling. And I just thought, okay, that's the way you do it.
Well, yes, but you're talking about putting on a show at CinemaCon as if that matters in the sense of what movies they are delivering in the world.
Well, the only reason
You had a fun time watching the Rockettes perform. It wasn't the Rockettes, but that doesn't change the quality of the movies or what they're having to offer.
That is correct. The only thing that it might help is, you might get, like, you know, a few more bookings. That's what it might help.
Right. But what I'm wondering is not how much fun did you have while you sat in the room watching their presentation, but what was the general tenor of the evening? Are theater owners feeling fat and happy? Are they feeling good about the industry and where they're going? Are they freaked out and concerned for some reason? What's going on there?
If they're freaked out and concerned, it's because of, you know, the stagnant attendance, not box office, because of course that's going up, and a part of that is ticket prices and other issues.
And they just had a record march of $1 billion, the first time in history.
Right. If they're feeling a little anxious, they're probably a smaller exhibitor, movie theater operator, wondering if they're going to be swallowed up by AMC, Regal, or somebody else, because there is going to be consolidation. That's everybody's big fear, and everybody knows that's coming because it keeps happening. And as far as technology goes, the other issue is, of course, digital cinema, which started in 1999, really, but really didn't take off until about 2006, and then really got a jump start from Avatar. It's nearing the 10-12 year mark where some of that equipment is going to be replaced. And so the question is, what do you replace it with? And who's going to pay for it?
Hold on a second. So we're talking about the switchover from celluloid to digital, which was a massive change.
Correct.
And the only reason it happened was because studios said, we will save tons of money if we don't have to ship negatives all over the country.
Correct.
So they wanted them to do it. So they helped theaters fund that by paying a virtual print fee?
Right. So instead of like Technicolor, hey, here's $1,500, make me a print. Instead, they paid the movie theater operator, hey, play my movie, here's $800. I'm only going to pay that until that equipment is paid off.
Right. So now after this period of time, that has happened, the equipment is paid off, and it doesn't mean they're going to still need to do upgrades and change it. Like when they bought a celluloid projector, that could last them 30, 40 years with good care, right?
Easily. And they were constantly, you know, bubble wrapping and taping and spit shining. Yeah, they were constantly trying to keep going.
But now they've switched over to a digital world, and now they have to face the first time where they have to say, things will change and improve and grow, and I have to decide, is this equipment outdated? Is it outmoded? Are they still going to service it in the format that I need so that I can show stuff on this way? Is that a concern? Are the studios going to suddenly say, we want this new, better format, and your old system isn't compatible with it? Is that going to happen?
Unlikely, very unlikely, because the studios got together and they have what's called the Digital Cinema Initiative, where they said, here are the requirements to show our movies. Okay, so everybody adheres to those requirements. If the studios change that, they would be upending their own industry. It is highly unlikely that they are going to change that.
So the theater owners have the projectors are paid off, or the digital projectors are paid off perhaps for most of them or all of them. Studios are pretty much almost done with paying virtual print fees. So that's a fee. Now they get to save that money every month, every time they put out a movie, rather than having to pay it. So that's a nice big chunk of money, isn't it?
Well, I would say what's happening is chunks of theaters, chunks of movie theater chains are beginning to come off the VPF. So slowly over the next 4 years, it'll be 100%.
Mm-hmm. So what the big technology change, there isn't any particular thing looming in digital projection.
Actually, but there is.
I thought it was a thing with the screen. I thought that was a different idea.
It is a different idea, but before you move on to the screen, and we'll, you know, just bear with us, audience. You'll kind of see where we're going with this. There's something called laser projection. Okay.
And oh, right, right, right.
So there's, and there's different types of laser. There's phosphor, which some people say isn't as good as the other type of laser, which is RGB. So you get a red, a green, and a blue laser.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Why do people want to switch from the current digital projection to laser projection? My understanding is it creates a much better, brighter picture. You don't have all the issues with theaters using crappy bulbs and blah, blah, blah. It's just a great, brighter, better picture.
Correct. And you could easily spend, you know, a fortune in bulbs each year for a projector, which is why sometimes, you know, you see maybe the screen is a little dim for one of two reasons or both. One, the theater owner turned down the brightness of the projector just a tad, just to save money and extend the life of the bulb, you know, another 3 weeks. Or the bulb is not burning as bright as it did when you first put it in, or a combination of both. So the xenon bulbs, as they're, you know, they're xenon, these big giant bulbs, those have a shorter lifespan. Laser projectors have a light engine that can last easily 10 years. So that's really, but by the way, they cost a fortune. So,
mm-hmm. Well, then does that mean that they're cheaper or the same price, but it's better quality for the whole 10-year period?
That's what they call the cost of ownership. And the manufacturers are trying to say, look, over the 10-year period, the cost of ownership is the same, if not better, with a laser projector. Manufacturers aren't producing xenon bulb projectors anymore. They're saying, look, this is the future. You must buy these laser projectors because the quality is that much better.
And now they're screwed because they can't just say, I'm sticking with my celluloid projector. I have to do something if you're not going to support the system I have in place.
Correct.
So they're not being screwed by the studios as such, but they are perhaps.
You mean not my xenon projector, because celluloid projectors are pretty much out anyway.
Right. I'm saying in the old days, if they'd stuck with their celluloid and said, we don't want to switch to digital, they'd be fine.
Right.
Because no one's going to suddenly stop supporting celluloid projectors. But now that they've made the switch to digital, now they're over a barrel. The studios have stopped paying for them. They're paid out. Now they're on their own. And suddenly people are saying, we're not going to support the format you use right now.
Well, they're saying we're not going to continue to manufacture projectors that use xenon bulbs. You can still play content on projectors that have xenon bulbs. Not a problem. In some cases, you can retrofit them with laser light engines, but any projector that you purchase moving forward will probably have a laser light source.
And that's got to be a nightmare, because they'd rather wait 40 years and not have to buy a new projector, right? They don't want to every 10 years have to buy something when it used to be in the old days they could hold on to it for 30 or 40 years.
Right, but everybody knew that once you went digital, you're talking about a 10, 12-year lifespan.
So somebody walks up and says, you want this laser. You want this laser thing. It's so awesome. But somebody else is out there and they're saying, no, don't go to laser. You want to go to LED, don't you? That's the really cool thing I read about.
Yes. Now, and it was without a doubt, there were two demonstrations. One was Samsung. It was offsite. They did not invite the press. They said they weren't inviting very many people, but then more and more people wound up going. And here's why. Sony decided, we're going to have a demonstration of these big giant screens, okay? They're kind of blocks of LED displays that are put together into one giant display. So you don't know.
Kind of like stacking a bunch of TVs, except it just looks like one big screen.
Exactly. You have no idea how many blocks there are unless somebody told you. And it's not just an LED television like you would get at home. It's not an LCD television like you would get at home.
It's far better. It's far better.
It's, yeah. And so on Monday, I was invited with a bunch of people that, some press, some industry technologists. And the show had not really started yet. And Sony said, okay, look, we want to get some feedback on this. Here's our laser projector. So we finally have that. But come next door and see this other thing that we have. And it was this giant screen. It was, I think it was 4K or 8K, between 4 and 8K, basically. Mm-hmm. And it was unbelievable. So they showed us the images and nobody said anything. The lights kind of come up and everybody's looking at one another like, okay, is anybody going to say anything? Because I think it looked kind of good, but I don't want to say that if everybody else is going to say it looked like crap. And finally, one person said, well, if nobody else will say it, I will say it. Game over. Now, that's true and not so true. By game over, what he was saying is the image quality is so much better that when you see it, you notice it. It's like going from standard def to high def.
So it's like the old days when you went from a VHS player, you plugged in your DVD player, and all of America, even your grandmother, said, wow, that looks a lot better. Any idiot can see how much better it is.
Absolutely. Now, The other issue,
and this would be walking into a movie theater, because I'm used to, we've been spoiled with great picture and sound in movie theaters now for quite a while, starting with THX to a degree. And so I'm used to going into a movie theater and expecting great picture and sound. And thanks to digital, full credit, you know, you don't see prints with tears or scratches or hairs in them anymore. You see a great picture from beginning to end. And you're saying if I walk into a movie theater and they use this new display system of LED or whatever it is, that I would go, wow, that's not just like the quality I expect. That is exponentially better.
Correct. Yes. And there are big giant displays. I went to the Apple store. There's a $1.2 million gigantic display, the kind that you might see in Times Square. Okay. And they look bright and big. But when you're that close, you know, you can kind of see pixels, right? Not on this. I mean, you had to get up really close to see that. There was no picture degradation. I mean, are there issues with it? Yes. The technology is evolving. And it's going to only get better. One of the issues,
more expensive than laser, right?
Oh my, you have no idea. I would not be shocked if the display we saw was over $1 million. Now, to give you some sense, you can buy a Xenon projector today for between $60,000 to $100,000 US. So, yeah.
So who the heck is going to want to increase their cost by 10 times as much?
Well, there's the rub. So my suggestion to them was, well, you should pre-sell a whole bunch of them. Pre-sell 1,000 of them. And that way, you know, you'll be making at least 1,000 instead of doing what you're doing today, which is building these as one-offs. So, of course, it's going to cost $1 million when you're building one of them. Just like, you know, digital projectors, when they were building, you know, 10, they cost $250,000 a pop. Now they're all, you know, below $100,000. Well, same concept. The other issue is sound. Right now, when you project a movie from the back of the theater onto a screen, the audio speakers are behind the screen and they're pointed out towards the audience. And, you know, you can...
I thought they were all over the room now.
Well, they are. So you get your surrounds all over the room and, you know, up above for Atmos. So those, you know, the subwoofer and all of your surrounds are everywhere. However, the main left, center, right, so for voice, a lot of the voice comes from the screen itself. You can't, of course, project sound, no pun intended, through an LED screen. So the question then becomes, well, how do you get sound to the audience so that it doesn't sound like it's coming from far off to the left when the person is sitting right in front of you? There are ways to do that now with directional audio and bidirectional audio. So that can be solved. It hasn't been yet.
Why is it different than like a TV where you're sitting in front of your TV?
Well, when you're sitting in front of your TV, you're pretty close to it. You're usually about 10 or 15 feet away. Also, that audio is coming from usually underneath, like directly underneath the...
Right.
So it's...
That's what I meant. A speaker's below the screen.
Right. And it's a much smaller surface area. So the left-right separation doesn't matter as much.
You saw Sony. How did that compare to Samsung's demonstration?
Well, okay, so I was not able to go to Samsung because, one, I wasn't invited. Thank you, Samsung. Two, it was off-site. So even if I was invited, I would have hesitated to go because anytime you leave the venue to go do something, you're talking about a half a day's worth of it becomes a problem.
So, even after seeing that first demonstration, you wouldn't have been like, wow, I need to see what this is because that was so amazing?
I would have been curious, but instead what I did was... some of the folks that work with us at Celluloid Junkie, I asked them, they had gone and they said, look, they're very comparable. The presentation that Sony had was a little better in terms of the actual, here it is, here's the presentation. Again, that doesn't matter. As you mentioned with the studio presentations, how you present something isn't necessarily the end, you know, what you're shooting for. You're looking for a great product. And from what everybody said is they're very, very comparable and both pop. Both screens kind of, the blacks are really black, the whites are very white. You can turn on the lights and there's no, you know, the image doesn't dim at all.
Okay.
So it's really good.
Here's my thing. Since the advent of color, I have not really noticed any change as such in the presentation of movies. I know you're talking about IMAX. That's a special separate issue in 3D. But just as far as you go to a movie theater and you see a movie, the quality of the presentation might vary based on whether you have a clean print and digital versus celluloid and stuff like that. But basically, if you've got a good projector, a good system, a good screen, the movie looks great. I didn't go to, I haven't been going to movies and thinking, wow, this movie looks better than it did 20. The presentation may be better because the quality of, and the standards of the equipment and everything is better, but the movie is the movie. And you're telling me this is like a leap forward in how it looks. Now, I've seen that with high frame rate, and that's been very questionable as far as it means a major adjustment to how movies are shot and makeup and sets and how they present it when you do a high frame rate. Same thing with TV. Would this lead to that same issue for film?
Yes. And what I would say is I'm setting you up for disappointment if you think you're going to go in and there's going to be the aha color moment. It's not that. It's just that the presentation and the colors are vivid. The saturation is perfect. The blacks are great. So if you're one of those junkies, no pun intended, who just loves, you know, clear, crystal clear, crisp images that pop, you'll be very, very pleased. There's no.
But does it need filmmakers to say, I want this, and thus we're going to adjust the whole way we make movies in order for it to work? Or can the movies shot as they are today work and look great on it? Because that's certainly not true with high frame rate.
I think the movies that you're shooting today can look great on it. I think the way you master for that particular display.
Well, that's a backroom issue.
Right.
That's a backroom issue. But as far as they wouldn't have to suddenly do their makeup different and their sets different and everything else different?
Well, it's so crystal clear that you might want to. But there's ways to, again, master so that you can kind of like fuzz it up a little bit so that it's not as clear. You know, you get that film look as opposed to that crystal clear video look.
And it's cool, but is there any compelling reason why a theater owner would want to spend 10 times as much?
Not right now. No. I mean, other than the fact that it looked really, really good.
So that was the one big cool thing was this display of, what do we call it? LED or what do we call it?
Direct display.
Direct display. So it's like a big TV.
Right.
Instead of a thing coming, an image coming from the back of the room going onto a screen, the image is in the screen coming out at you like you if you're watching your television.
Correct. Although it far surpasses
television.
It's
more
television. Yeah.
Yeah, but the TVs are pretty great now. So that was one of the big things. The studio showed a bunch of stuff. And then the other thing, which was not discussed on the stages a lot at CinemaCon, right, was this whole early window.
Yeah, Sue Kroll mentioned it, and she's from Warner Brothers. She's one of the heads of marketing at Warner Brothers, and she said, we all know that people are changing their habits and want to know how, you know, get content earlier and in the format that they want. And literally, when she was done saying that, you could hear a pin drop in the auditorium. 3,000 people, you could probably hear somebody whisper in the back of the room. I mean, it was just, you know, I was thinking.
She got their attention.
Yeah, wrong audience. but yeah, I mean, I think. Now, unlike last year where, you know, there was the screening room was this company that came
third party company trying to come in and say, pay us money. We want to be part of this. We want to get a cut.
Yeah, there was very little talk about it beyond the opening day after the Variety published their article. Brent Lang kind of published this article saying, you know, oh, the studios are really scared. Everybody's scared of this, you know, that the industry is changing. The business model's changing. And I think Variety had a piece that was similar to that. And beyond that, and then when John Fithian spoke, John Fithian is the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, NATO, the trade organization that puts on CinemaCon, that produces the show. He then spoke with not only to the audience, to the delegates there, where he mentioned that, hey, trade deals work both ways. We sell a lot of corn to Mexico for popcorn. So, you know, if you're going to start talking about trade issues, no matter who is saying it, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter. Keep in mind, that could affect our business. Afterwards, he spoke with journalists, and it took about 30 minutes before somebody brought up premium video on demand. And then that's pretty much all the rest of the press conference was about that. So
we know the studios are incredibly serious about this, and they are convinced it must happen. Did you get the sense that theater owners are very concerned about this and are convinced also it will happen and that they're going to have to deal with this?
Well, here's what I got. And I got this on background. I got this off the record. I won't say from who because it was off the record. But a very reliable source, and I should say source says, and this is what I thought, but I confirmed it at CinemaCon. And that is, if you look at the news stories that are being published about PVOD and you look at who's being quoted and what is being said, what you really see is a lot of terms coming from studios. You hear very little coming from exhibitors. Mm-hmm. You hear, well, exhibitors want the following. They want a moratorium for 10 years on talking about you know, early release windows if they agree to, or they want 45 days instead of 30, or they want to be cut in on. So there, what you're really, my suspicion at the time was, gee, the studios aren't technically allowed to talk to one another, even though everybody believes they do. So they're not allowed to get into a room and say, what is it that we want? They have to talk to each theater chain individually. However, they can try to do this through the press. They can try to negotiate through the press. So Warner Brothers puts out what they want through Variety or The Hollywood Reporter or The Rap.
Right, we've got all that, yeah.
And
they've all got slightly different spins on what they think is based on their type of movies they release and how they're doing. They've all got different ideas of how to approach this.
Right. And so with that in mind, you're beginning to see, well, we don't like that, what Variety reported, which might be what Warner Brothers had to say, or we like what Universal had to, you know, and it's a really bad way to negotiate. It was basically confirmed for me that that is what the studios are trying to do, is use the press to put terms out there for exhibitors to shoot down or agree with or say, well, that's not so bad.
I'm sure they're saying the same things privately in closed-door sessions with each individual major exhibitor.
The question is, are they? How many of those meetings have actually taken place?
Isn't that what was happening during this event? Are you telling me there weren't meetings between the studios and individual exhibitors?
Well, okay.
To talk about this issue? I'm just assuming this was what they met. This is why you go to the convention. You go to meet behind closed doors. You can meet, have a meeting with AMC 1 minute and Cinemark the next and somebody else the next. And in one day you've met all the major exhibitors and to discuss things. And, you know, that's how you do it, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Now, what I would point out, you're absolutely right. This is exactly where such conversations might take place, studio to exhibitor, you know, one on one. Okay.
Yeah.
However, everything that was reported beforehand was all reported before CinemaCon, before those conversations would take place. And the question,
it was what different studios wanted, yeah, and what plan they were going to push, that
right.
sort of thing.
So now they could say, hey, this is what exhibitors want. But the question on everybody's minds was, who's meeting with the studios? We're not meeting with this. Are you meeting with the studios? We're not talking to the studios about this. Well, that might have changed over the past week.
Well, first of all, my question was, studios want this to happen. Did you have any sense that exhibitors want this to happen or expect this to happen or have accepted that this will happen?
I get the feeling that exhibitors feel that they are supposed to want this to happen or expect it to happen, but they don't really want it to happen, even though they're mm-hmm. being told you should expect this to happen. So, you know, you should get used to it. It's going to happen. And they keep going, well, I guess I'll get used to it. But why am I getting used to this again? Who told me I should be getting used to
it? Yeah. Why is this happening? I don't understand why this is happening.
Who's talking to the studios about this? Nobody seems to really want this to happen on the exhibition side, even though they're willing to concede, okay, look, we understand that you want this. However, we're going to want a whole lot if we actually agree to any of this. And right now, we're not even thinking we should talk to you about it.
Well, we know that the studios are serious about it. And, you know, they can try and, I guess, you know, they want to collapse the major windows, one of the major windows in movie distribution. It's a big change. And to be clear, many films are already available on demand or for streaming day and date with theatrical release or even before theatrical. That's been going on for years now. It's just those movies are tiny.
Correct.
They're documentary films. They're independent films. This is not a new thing, but it would be new for major studio releases. And against all logic, they don't seem to be talking about doing it for like a flop. I thought for a while that they meant, well, you know what? If a movie collapses, why are we waiting 3 months to put it out? Let's just put it out quicker to the next level because, you know, it's over. It's out of theaters. And I understood that. But they seem to want to be doing this for most movies, depending on which studio you're talking to. Right. So it seems to be Disney's like, we don't need this. We're doing fine. And, you know, other studios like Fox and Paramount and Warner Brothers, they want it to happen more and they want different price levels and all that. So you feel like there's a big resistance from exhibitors because they're like, hey, the current system's working. It's pretty darn quick like I'm saying with Get Out. It's pretty darn quick already. Why do you need to make it even tighter?
Correct. That's my feeling. That's, you know, and I do believe that in some instances, you do want to, you know, kind of move up the date. But at the end of the day, a theatrical release does have some value. Okay, and let me ask you: do you know the film Tallulah?
The what's her name? The actress who came out. Ellen Page. Yeah. Yeah, sure. I know who Tallulah. Yeah.
Okay, so you know that.
But I mean, that's because I'm in the industry.
Correct. Most people don't. They have no idea what I'm talking about. Or Barry, the film that was about, Barack Obama, the biopic.
Right, you're talking about movies that flopped.
No, they were never in theaters because they were all on Netflix. So what I'm saying is sometimes a theatrical release is a marketing campaign unto itself.
We all know that.
Right. I know that. You know that. And I think sometimes the studios need to be reminded.
So right now we've got a current window system where on day one, a big studio film is released in theaters. And then typically on day 70,
90, it's going to be. Yeah.
No, on day 70 is when you're going to start to get digital copies available for sale.
Okay, yes.
And then
yeah.
on day 90, you're going to get physical DVD and Blu-ray, which is diminishing in importance, but it still matters. Somewhere in the middle, there are airlines and hotel rooms. And then beyond that, you have the windows for pay cable and basic cable and major networks and video on demand and stuff like that. That's been going on for a few years now, and that's where you're at. And if a big movie keeps playing, like La La Land, they're not going to rush it onto digital or DVD and Blu-ray because they're making money.
Correct. And
so they
and,
say, all right, it's got legs. Let's let it play out.
And NATO says, and I kind of, you know, there's empirical evidence for this, that there are two spikes of piracy. One is when the theatrical release occurs. You know, that's when piracy goes up on that particular title. And the other is when the home video release occurs. So by moving those two windows together, those two piracy spikes together, you're really just, you could be decreasing the revenue for a title substantially.
Does that happen because that's when copies become available to pirates, meaning there is a digital copy and or in the old days, a physical celluloid copy
correct.
Roaming around. And then when you put it on DVD and Blu-ray and or a digital copy for home entertainment, then you're making it available again to people who can't access it at the other level.
Correct.
Okay, so it's just you're giving them access. Why give them access sooner? But that's sort of the argument where like you've got bootleg DVDs in a country. You want to make sure you still make it available in the theater just to keep people out of the habit of buying it on bootleg DVD.
Correct. And what I would say to answer your question directly, do I think this is going to happen? I would say if it does, it's not going to be as easy as everybody thinks.
Mm-hmm. So right, that's the old system. Day one, day 70, digital copies. Day 90, you got DVD and Blu-ray. Somewhere in there is airlines and hotel rooms. And then you got cable and all the rest of this stuff. Nowadays, you're going from day one, a theatrical release for a big movie, to day 10, where Universal says, hey, let's make a movie available for $40. Or day 17, where Warner Brothers says, let's make a movie available for $50. Or day 20, where Paramount says, hey, we've done this before. We did it with Halloween movies. Or day 45, where Fox and Sony and Paramount seem to be heading with $30 rentals. Or day never, which Disney says, leave things the way they are. So every studio's got a different idea. Some want movies to, you know, be triggered for this new window if they collapse. Others say, hey, we want people to know what to expect. We want them to know, we want to train them. Day one is in the theaters. Day 30 is on this premium on demand. Day 70, you know, they want consistency. Universal wants every film included. Other studios say, hey, you know, we're talking mid-level Hollywood movies. The big blockbuster tempo, maybe we're not going to rush out. So right. There's a lot of disagreement among studios. It's dramatic change in the windows, and there seems to be a lot of resistance from exhibitors. So something that in the trades feels like this is happening, it's going to happen, you're saying not so fast.
Not so fast, and it's going to be a lot harder than everybody thinks.
All right.
And you know, the movie industry isn't the only industry that's ever had windows. When you are a product manager, versioning your product is a form of windows, right? So you have one version of a product, product A, and you sell it for a while, and then you know you kind of tweak it a little bit, and it's lowercase a, and you sell it again. Well, the book industry has been doing that for years with hardcovers and then paperbacks and then ebooks. Now, of course, they all come out on the same day, so it doesn't really matter, right?
Well, it used to be. I mean, paperbacks don't always come out on the same day. For most books, that doesn't happen, but that is possible. And of course, in the old days, there was even serialized, where you would serialize a book in a magazine and then put it together into one copy that you could buy in, as a hardcover or paperback back in the 1800s and 1900s. So the windows change all the time. But yes, it is time for Bookfilter, isn't it?
That's right. Bookfilter is a book lover's best friend. Michael, each week you pick a few books for our listeners to check out, and especially books that you think Hollywood should be reading.
Well, I'm shocked. Is this not already optioned? It's called American War. It's by Omar El Akkad and got a rave review by Machiko in the New York Times. Just a hugely, massively big review. And all the trades have given it a great review. It's a dystopian novel. You might think of it as sort of like The Hunger Games, but it's more literary fiction with a sci-fi element. You know, when it's good, people say, well, that's not sci-fi. That's just a dystopian novel. It's a sci-fi novel. It's about the Second American Civil War, which begins in 2074. And that's your first hint. It's set in 2074. That means it is, by definition, a sci-fi novel. But anyway, Louisiana is underwater. There are unmanned drones filling the skies. There are camps where people are sent. It's dystopian. And there's a young girl who will play a key role in determining the future. But this is really serious literary fiction. It's getting great reviews, but it does have the vibe of The Hunger Games, I have to say.
Heck, it has the vibe of Blade Runner, for Pete's sake.
And I'm just, if it's not optioned already, it will be in a New York Minute.
Speaking of being optioned, I heard that Lincoln in the Bardo was optioned.
That's right. We were talking about who would be a good director to do it. I'm like, I'm not sure this should be made into a film. I think Tim Burton would do a bad job. I'm not sure about Spielberg. I don't know. It was optioned by Megan Mullally and Nick Offerman, of all people. God bless them. They're both talented, lovely people. He writes books and they're both actors and they're fun. I love them both, but I didn't see that one coming. I'm sure they could have made a deal with anyone in Hollywood, and that's who they went with. So we'll have to see what happens.
Well, if it comes out and is a success, I guess, you know.
You're trying to say it's going to be a big deal because it's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Do I need you?
You know, we should probably keep that, shouldn't we?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, well, in that case, no, you don't need me. Just, you know, just go down Big Deal, Big Whoop, Whoop. Big whoop, and yeah, no.
And when you're not here, believe me, I argue with myself.
Well, okay, then our first story, in New York, we've got weekly box office reports on every Broadway show. What they grossed, average ticket price, you name it. In London, it's a mystery. They think it's tacky, shocking even, how everyone in New York talks about grosses. At least we get an annual snapshot. The Society of London Theatre released figures for 2016, and the overall story is pretty good. Gross revenue for the West End was $800 million, a tick up over 1 year earlier. Attendance was down almost 3%, but hold on. The number of performances was down 6%, so in context, that's actually quite good. In fact, 76.7% of all seats were sold, a new high, and the average ticket price rose to $56. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, and it's good news because you want a healthy London theater market because that's where a lot of great shows come to New York from. So it's great to see. And I have to say, this spring, Broadway is on fire. Looking at the shows last week, a lot of the new shows were over 90%. There's a lot of shows opening up this month, and people are really actively and aggressively seeking them out. I was surprised by Anastasia and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory doing even better as far as filling seats than Groundhog Day, because Groundhog Day got great reviews in London. So that's one of the musicals I'm perhaps looking the most forward to. But as my friend Zoe pointed out, hey, it's spring break. A lot of people have school breaks on, families with kids. They're going to want to go see Anastasia and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. That is until their friends tell them how good it was.
Now, here's a question. So when I'm in town next week, should I try and get tickets for Dear Evan Hansen, or is that just a pointless effort?
Well, it's hard because you're coming up on Tony time, so there's not going to be Tony people going. So it's definitely, this is the season, but there's no reason not to, and you certainly want to see it with the original cast. So if you have any chance at all, give it a shot. Have you not booked anything?
I have not booked, I haven't booked anything.
All right.
You know, I plan ahead.
Oh, well, buy a single ticket. Absolutely. You can walk up the day before. You can go see Jake Gyllenhaal, which you absolutely should, as long as you're willing to pay $200.
All right. Well, I'd love to see Robert Downey Jr. play Dr. Doolittle, because only in Hollywood could a remake of Dr. Doolittle be a hot property. We're not talking the modern Eddie Murphy reboot. We're talking the classic children's book that was once one of Hollywood's most notorious flops when it became a musical starring Rex Harrison. Now Robert Downey Jr. is the one who's going to walk with the animals and talk with the animals and listen to what they have to say. A bidding war broke out over the script written by Steven Gagan of Traffic and Syriana fame. Those are the films he's written. And Universal Pictures won the bidding war. Gagan will also be directing, even though his last film was Gold with Matthew McConaughey, or as most people would say, what? When did that come around? Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. My goodness, why would this suddenly be a hot property? I guess it must have been a hell of a script.
Advertisers need to reach people where they are, and today that means on their phones and computers and tablets. Surveys estimate that the online ad market will reach $205 billion this year. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's worldwide. I couldn't quite track how much of a growth that is, but it sounds like a lot of money to me. So it seems it's good, but again, it's spread out over so many sites that it feels like, yeah, you know, it's a lot of money and you're reaching people, but it's hard to create a strong ecosystem where the money is spread out so thinly. You know, it's a lot of money, but there's so many billions of websites, it doesn't add up a lot, does it?
Well, it depends on whether some of the big giants scoop up 70% of that money, which very often they do.
Yeah.
The Smithsonian Channel announced a major new series. It's called America in Color, and it plans to tell the story of America by transforming old black and white photos, newsreels, and TV show clips into glorious color. Because what better way to present history than to distort it? Elvis on Ed Sullivan, the Jazz Age, bread lines during the Great Depression, and more, all in living color. Is this a big deal? Or, you know what? Never mind. I know what you're going to say about this. You hate this.
Oh, you know what I'm going to say is that if MTV did this, I would say that's a stupid idea because MTV runs music videos in black and white all the time. Just like kids who watch MTV are used to musicals. They have no problem with it. They're used to black and white because there's lots of cool videos that go in black and white. And black and white is not an absence of color. It is a choice. I understand 100 years ago, they didn't really have a choice other than to tint it or be in black and white. But nonetheless, you light it, you shoot it, you have sets and costumes. It's all different when you shoot in black and white. So black and white is not, oh, it's missing color. And for Smithsonian to do it, oh my God, my head explodes.
Well, then
maybe I hate it so much. It's Smithsonian, for God's sake. I mean, ridiculous.
Price Waterhouse is safe for one more year. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, you know, those guys that throw the Oscars, they announced that they would stick with the accounting firm for tabulating who has won the Oscars next year. But they've put changes in place to prevent any snafus. A third accountant will be in the control room with the director who knows the results so they can start screaming, "There's been a mistake! There's been a mistake! They've pulled another La La!" Although, wouldn't they say they've pulled another Moonlight? In any case, the typography on the envelopes and on the cards themselves will be changed. And of course, the two accountants from last year are gone and the new players will not be tweeting during the show. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? It was a once in a 30 year of mistake. They fixed the obvious things that they should have, not meeting the people as such, but the typography, making sure there's somebody there who actually knows as well, who can raise their hand and say, "Oops." But, you know, so yeah, big whoop.
Finish the book. Okay. That's the cruel, unfair, none of their business message of fans to fantasy author George R.R. Martin, who is not allowed to go to the movies, watch a baseball game, have dinner out on the town, or do anything other than keep writing his fantasy series, Game of Thrones, which has been overshadowed by the TV series that it's now known as Game of Thrones instead of A Song of Ice and Fire. His latest outrage? What do you think it is? It's helping to launch a movie studio lot in Santa Fe, New Mexico to try and recruit movie and TV and commercial folk to bring some production to his hometown and increase local jobs and the such. How dare he? Meanwhile, the trailer for the summer season of Game of Thrones is out and it looks pretty good. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, perfectly fine thing for him to do. And I bet he, like us, just can't wait to see the end of the show here and find out what happens.
Yeah, so that he can write it down. Oh, exactly. That's a good idea.
Hey! I feel the same way about Susan Laurie Parks, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. And she has a series of plays called When Daddy Comes Home from the Wars. I hope I'm getting the name exactly right. I saw parts like 3, 4, and 5, or 4, 5, and 6, something like that. Terrifically entertaining, terrifically good. And every time I see her, I'm like, get writing. She has a band. She performs in this theater space called Signature. And I'm like, go home and write. I want to see the rest of those plays.
Here's a pen. Here's some paper. The White House Correspondents' Dinner usually makes news after the fact, when the media reports on whether the comic was too mean to the president or too nice. This year, it's making news for happening at all. Time Magazine and People are the latest to drastically change their annual ritual around the fundraiser. Both have dumped parties they usually hold the night before. People Magazine won't be attending at all and is making a donation, while Time is apparently still planning to go. Trump, of course, won't be there at all since it's a fake event and no one's going to actually be there anyway, right? I mean, come on. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. I hope it's not just an annual reaction to Trump, but a rethinking of this event, which should not be you palling around with the president saying, oh, we're best friends. It's not what you're supposed to raise funds for journalism. Behave like journalism. Don't pal around with the president, even if you like them that year.
Bad news all around at Fox News. Bill O'Reilly had to apologize for making fun of the hair of Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Then researchers dug up a bunch of other clips of Fox News hosts belittling the politician in racial terms, such as telling her to drop the crack pipe and the like.
Oh, my God, that was bad.
Yeah, pretty bad. Then the New York Times did a massive front page investigation showing how O'Reilly has repeatedly over the years been accused of sexually harassing and otherwise demeaning women at the workplace. 5 women have been paid more than $13 million that we know of for his behavior. O'Reilly insists it's all untrue, though actually he's paid $10 million out of his own pocket of that total to these women. On the other hand, O'Reilly is their number one draw. Fox News pays him $18 million a year and just had its highest rated quarter ever in terms of total audience throughout the day.
Oh, and they just re-upped him. I should have pointed that out, too. Yes.
Yes. Bad news? Did someone say bad news? Eh, who cares? Big deal or big whoop?
Actually, there's more. So there was the good news there of their ratings, and he's just been re-upped. They're like, in the midst of all this, they said, you know what? We're going to re-sign him anyway. He's our number one host. Let's just do it now and get it over with, which is probably smart PR-wise. But in fact, another Fox News employee has come forward and says Ailes wanted sex in exchange for promotion. She is suing Fox News. And now, because of this coverage in the Times, 3 different car manufacturers have pulled their ads, not from Fox News, but from the O'Reilly factor in particular. Mercedes-Benz, Hyundai, and BMW all said, yeah, we kind of want women to buy our car, and maybe that's not the best environment right now. And this is what happened to Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck had big ratings, but eventually the only advertising he was getting was really crappy advertising, gold and crap like that. And, you know, you want nice, classy advertisers with a lot of money to spend. And if Bill O'Reilly can become persona non grata in the ad world, that may well affect his position at Fox News, ratings or no ratings, because they dropped Glenn Beck not because his ratings fell so much, but just because he was becoming a liability in terms of advertising. And that could be a problem in the future for Bill O'Reilly. But hey, let's not just point the news at Fox News. CNN is facing a class action lawsuit on systemic racism. And once it was announced, they claimed, the lawyers, that like several hundred people have come forward to add their names to it or to share their stories with what's gone on with them at CNN.
Well, in regards to the Bill O'Reilly story in the New York Times, I get the New York Times on Sundays. I was shocked to see the size of this story on the front page. I kind of looked at it and went, I don't know how he, I mean, probably make it through this, but it's going to be tough.
Well, you know, it's a different world. And it's just like, we can't adjudicate every single accusation and thing. You assume when someone makes a charge, most of the time they're telling the truth. That's not always fair to a person who is in the public eye, who has to deal with this. But when you've got multiple people and paying out $13 million, you cannot say, well, I just paid him to go away. And, you know, they're all lying. It's like at a certain point, it just, I don't know what that tipping point is, but at a certain point you go, you know what? Bill Cosby raped women. You know what? Bill O'Reilly sexually harasses women. It's clearly you're not paying out $13 million because you want them to go away.
Yeah,
it's cheaper to fight them with lawyers.
Well,
I'm sorry.
And when these women are coming out and they're saying, no, it's me. I will tell you, I'm the one making the accusation.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So not good.
Michael, you always enjoy talking about the range of sound recordings that get added to the National Registry every year. This time around, they range from the first episode of All Things Considered to the last broadcast of a Dodgers and Giants baseball game at the Polo Grounds. It was called by Vin Scully, who retired just last year. From Judy Garland singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow to the Talking Heads album Remain in Light. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a lot of fun. It's big fun. It's the Library of Congress adding 25 recordings to the National Registry. And it's just cool to, you know, follow the link. How the reporter had a really good breakdown of the different pieces and why they're important and what the context is. One thing I didn't know was one of the things included is Judy Collins and her version of Amazing Grace. And included in the choir of people singing in the background was her then boyfriend, Stacy Keach.
Oh.
I didn't know she dated Stacy Keach. I can't imagine him singing in a choir. I can't imagine him singing Amazing Grace. But that just goes to show I really don't know Stacy Keach. But that's a lot of fun.
You know, you thought Netflix was crazy to make four movies with Adam Sandler. Remember that?
Well, crazy.
Yeah, or crazy like a fox, maybe. The streaming site just announced it would be making four more movies with Sandler. Sure, they could have said it was all a big success and everyone was happy and who would have ever known, right? It's not like we could measure ratings. Let's face it, they never say anything about how many people are watching those shows. But with Netflix doing it all over again, we have to assume it was good business for all involved. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. You see the money they're writing for these comedy shows and you think, dear God, does that make any sense? And the Adam Sandler thing, people mock that. They're doing it again. I think it's pretty safe to say they're not saying, well, that was dumb, let's do it again. I think they're saying, that worked, let's do it again.
Yeah, well, you know what Adam Sandler is saying. I'd stick around to defend myself, but I'm too busy adding on, putting an addition onto my house.
Yeah, God bless him.
Netflix is doubling down on Adam Sandler, and Marvel Comics is doubling down on Spider-Man, Thor, Iron Man, and the like. The execs at the company say they don't like it, but they claim fans simply haven't shown any interest in the moves towards diversity that the company has been trying to make in its lineup of comic books. More women? More people of color? A gay character, maybe. Hey, they'd love to, but people don't want it. Sales prove it, and what can they do? So expect more and more comics focused on the usual suspects and less of Miss Marvel. Big deal or big whoop?
Hold on. Wait a second. Never mind. That's what Marvel says. All that stuff that people from our company said, no. Never mind. No, not true. They say, no, actually, Ms. Marvel and Squirrel Girl and the Mighty Thor are very popular. They're not going anywhere. A 15-year-old black woman became the new Iron Man. She's now known as Iron Heart. Ooh. A biracial teen became Spider-Man. That was back in 2011. These characters are popular. They're doing good. They're not going anywhere. Whatever issues we have with sales, it is not because of our push towards diversity. So just because we just said that, ignore that. Don't pay attention to any of that, what we just said. So they had some fall in sales, and one of their people tried to spin it as, yeah, you know, people are really sick of all this diversity. Didn't go over well, and probably not true, and they certainly have some characters that they're still invested in that they don't want to feel like they're pulling the plug on. So kind of a PR snafu for Marvel, and when they want to know why are they not selling as many comic books, they might want to look more at too much product. You know, they overwhelm the market with product. Both of the DC and Marvel do that. How good a job are they doing at marketing to new readers? If you've got a new push for diversity, that gives you an opportunity to reach new readers rather than the schlubby middle-aged white guys like me who are, you know, taking their comics and putting them in sealed Mylar so nobody can touch them. You know, you want to reach new people when you got new storylines. And, of course, people who drifted away that might be excited by this stuff. So they got a lot of things to deal with. A push for more and interesting characters is not the problem.
An acclaimed TV series is canceled, and usually the cry goes out, who wants to save the show, right? That doesn't quite seem to be the case for the Cinemax drama The Nick, or is it a Showtime drama? Anyway, The Nick. It's created by Steven Soderbergh. It enjoyed two low-rated but highly acclaimed seasons on the pay channel and reached a natural conclusion with the storyline of Clive Owen. The plan was to reboot the drama decades later at the same hospital with a new cast and do another two self-contained season story arc. But Cinemax passed and no one else seems to be interested, or maybe Steven Soderbergh isn't interested, I don't know. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop, I guess, but what a weird thing. I mean, I just waited for somebody to say, hey, you know, and it didn't. I guess maybe Soderbergh just tamped it down if anybody was interested, because it seemed like it made sense. It was such good acclaim. It was on Cinemax, not Showtime. So it's HBO's little brother. So it never got quite the traction. And I guess the ratings were so low, nobody had any interest. But it's not often you see a show get that much interest and there's no desire to keep it going. I didn't even hear it from fans. So I guess that shows how little interest there was. On the other hand, HBO's miniseries Big Little Lies, when you talk about getting the word out about when a show is a success, I had the sense that The Nick was, just because it got great press. Big Little Lies, I got the impression it wasn't a big success because I didn't know anybody who was talking about it. And the first overnights I saw said 2 million, which can be okay. But guess what? Now they put out a press release. It's actually more like 7 million when you add everything in. So 7 million viewers a night for Big Little Lies, that's a more of a success story. And they can say, hey, look how well we did. So again, pushing your overnight ratings doesn't make any sense to me because you're just downplaying how much of a big success your show might be.
And I love The Nick. It's a great show.
So. Yeah, I've heard it was a lot of fun, but you know, it's not going to happen. I mean, it was going to be new people, new period, and all that sort of stuff. But I thought it was such a great premise. It's a shame, but that's not happening. But there is the guy. Speaking of TV, the Jordan Klepper on Comedy Central. They just give him the post Daily Show slot. You know, the guy who's going to follow the Daily Show, it's going to be Jordan Klepper. One of their correspondents is leaping to his own show. And you know what? 4 or 5 years ago, that would have been a big deal. But today, it's a big whoop.
Yeah, well, it's not a big whoop for Chris Hardwick, who has been in that slot with At Midnight. So no,
but he's got like, well, that show's still around, and he's got like 3 other game shows and a science show called That's Awesome and another game show, something in primetime. He's got a lot of stuff going on. He'll be just fine.
Yeah, I'm sure he doesn't mind. Well, you know, Michael, we spoke too soon about the final album from the late, great Chuck Berry. Apparently, the new album they announced was made up of tracks that had mostly been recorded already. Berry spun out a string of great singles in the 1950s and 1960s, so no one can blame him for slowing down. He'd written a new song and recorded a track here or there for the past 20 years, and at least 5 or 6 of those songs were good to go. So there will be a final album, even if he wasn't able to put the final touches on it himself, and it's coming out in June. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a big whoop. You know, it would have been nice if he could have toured. It'd be awesome if it was like some great final burst of creativity like you have saw with Leonard Cohen and Johnny Cash. But given the makeup of the album and how it came together, it sounds like it's just the best of what he had over the last 15 or 20 years. So I'm not that excited for it creatively. But you know, it's been a long time since he did something good. And those final bursts of energy are rare, and it doesn't sound like that was quite the case here.
Yeah, and you know, what's interesting is I read this story in Rolling Stone magazine, and it arrived on Friday. Chuck Berry had passed away 2 weeks earlier, and they didn't even mention that. Like, it was written, obviously, before he passed away.
Oh, about the new album promotion thing,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that was the press release of the, yeah.
Yeah, and so they were saying, like, oh, it's unlikely he'll tour. I'm like, yeah, it's unlikely he'll tour. I highly doubt he'll tour. In a major ruling, the Brazilian government is adding, get this, retransmission fees to the pay TV world. Right now, the cable, satellite, and telco companies can carry Brazilian TV on their packages for free, even though those channels are the biggest draw for consumers. With the industry switching from analog to digital in Brazil by 2018, it seemed a good time for the government to also tell pay TV companies they have to pony up for the right to carry those channels. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal because, you know, that's where they were making the money on, but they were profiting from channels and stuff that they didn't have to pay for. So the TV networks, if you like Brazilian TV and you want them to survive and create new programming, they need to get paid. So it's good that they're getting a cut of the pie.
Google is facing a firestorm of criticism from major media companies over ads on, well, YouTube. Major advertisers are annoyed to see their commercials placed with offensive videos by the far right and so on. It caught attention when AT&T and Verizon pulled their ads from YouTube, but a string of other big-name companies also pulled ads and are demanding Google do a better job of making sure they aren't linked to controversial videos. At the same time, pop duo Tegan and Sarah pointed out how annoying it was that their polite, non-explicit songs about respecting gay people were being blocked by YouTube's restricted mode. With 500 hours of footage added every minute to YouTube, it's not easy being the parent of online videos. You can't win. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, they've got advertisers. When the story began, some people said, they're just trying to give Google and YouTube a hard time. They just want lower rates, all that sort of stuff. But the more and more people you see pulling ads and being concerned, the more serious it is. Nobody wants their stuff on controversial sites that are going to piss people off. Of course, the standard of what pisses people off varies from person to person, but there's some clear no-nos when you're a major advertiser, like explicit sex or, you know, racist video. The thing is, it's easily fixable. They just don't want to do it. They just say, you approve them. You approve a provider of video and say, we'll only put your ads on the ones that are approved. And if you want to add a new one, YouTube is going to have to approve them. But right now, they just put it out on most things. And if you point it out or they catch something, then they pull it back. So they do it after the fact. And that works out okay, unless you're actually paying attention, in which case it doesn't. So they could fix it easily, but it's in a way that would make a lot more work for YouTube.
Well, actually, this has been, you know, you say it's easy, but one of the the commentary on this over the past 2 weeks is that it is actually hard because so many videos are being uploaded.
No, but you don't include among advertisers for General Motors unless it's an already approved source of video, meaning MTV's videos on there, all the people who create content that are approved, whatever you accept. You don't approve each video. You approve the people creating it. So you don't add in people just because Michael Gillis posts a video doesn't mean you put ads in there unless for some reason they decide, all right, I've created enough videos, I'm getting enough views that it's worth their time to process me and see if I'm objectionable or not, whether I'm a trustworthy source of video.
I see what you're saying.
That means big corporate videos and all that stuff will be fine. But they don't want to have to bother with ignoring the 100 million other videos created by schmucks. But guess what? That's where the problems are.
Right. Well, and it was an issue that was raised for at least the past year, maybe two, but it only became serious when people started pulling their ads. So once again, the almighty
money.
Dollar. Yeah, money.
Absolutely.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop, and I can do this transition on my own without two or three takes, because now it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And maybe this week's story hasn't affected you yet unless you are a member of the Writers Guild of America.
That's right. This is the possibility that there's going to be a strike.
That's right. And so every couple of years, and by couple, I mean like 3 to 5, the Writers Guild of America, the Directors Guild of America, the Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, they have these contracts with the studios and the producers. And these are for minimums and for certain clauses in contracts that are just bare bones and basic. This is what you'll get. And if you're a signatory of SAG or WGA or DGA, that stuff just goes into the contract period for all WGA or DGA or SAG members. Well, it's come time to renew the WGA contract. And you might recall back in 2007, there was a little bit of a strike, if you recall.
Yeah.
And so now, the big issues. Now, the DGA, it should be pointed out, the DGA has already agreed to a new deal, okay? And it included some streaming stuff. We talked about this in the past when they cut their deal.
And that usually sets the tone for everybody else. Whoever goes first, like the DGA, that sets the tone for, all right, they got this. That sort of sets the bar for what people can expect or hope or push for if they're willing to go along with what the DGA got.
Right. And so the Writers Guild told the producers, look, we'll hash this thing out. We probably only need about 2 weeks. But here's the things we want. We want, of course, what the DGA got. We want, we have some issues here. We have holds, okay? And we'll explain what that is in a second. We have healthcare. We want parity, okay? So at least three things. And here's what we mean. A hold. Right now, when you do a show, whether it's for Netflix or a network.
NBC, yeah.
Yeah, the network will hold you and say, I'm sorry, writer, you can't go off and work on another TV show because what if we pick you up? Okay, if we pick you up for another 12 shows or for next season, you have to be available to come work for us.
And that's cool. But the problem is, with all this explosion of TV shows and dramas online and on streaming sites and Netflix and all this stuff, and the whole different way people are approaching television, instead of getting a job where you have 22 episodes for NBC, you're getting a job, even if it's for HBO, for 10 episodes.
Right.
And they're still holding you for the same amount of time. So you're getting less work, but you're just as much blocked from other stuff as you were before. So you're getting less money for less work, of course, but you're trapped and you can't do it. What if there's a new season of The Affair? You can't do other stuff because you got to wait around to find out whether you're free to work on something else.
Right. So it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of an analogy here, but
you got a cut in pay and you can't do any other jobs.
Right. Exactly. you know, you get a cut in pay. Okay, fine. You know, but since I'm working less for you, sir, I will go over and work for another employer with that new extra free time. And the network say, yeah, you can't do that. Okay. So not only are you going to be making less because you will be doing less, but you are frozen from working until such time as we release you. This is why agents now have tons of clients because of all these holds, not only for writers, but also more so for actors.
Well, actors, directors, everybody. Yeah, it's a problem for everybody.
Yeah, so that's what holds mean. They want to negotiate something around that. So that's
right,
number one.
Because they say, you got to be available. If we start a new season of The Nick and you're in it, well, that's different because it's a whole new cast. But you got to start a new season of The Blacklist Redemption, a show that's on the bubble perhaps for NBC. All those actors, they can't recast the roles if they decide to go forward. So you have to wait and find out if your show is going to get picked up for another season.
Right. Now, the other
which is understandable, but right. It's a new world now with so many shorter seasons going on.
And then there's healthcare, which is the Writers Guild Healthcare Fund, their pension and welfare, so to speak, is underfunded. Now, I don't know enough about this, I will admit. But
all I know is that the numbers that they talked about, 8 million, 14 million, and then last year, I think 25 million underfunded. And I'm like, that's it?
Yeah, well,
that's the number we're talking about?
Well, here's the thing. They keep talking about it going bankrupt in 2 or 3 years. What I want to know is, wait, shouldn't you be managing your money better? Is that really the studio's issue? But again, I don't know enough about it.
Well, yeah, because the studios will chip in money towards right. it. So yeah, no, it's about what the studios are, their share of kicking in for healthcare. It's not that they're not managing their money properly. That's not the issue necessarily. It's saying, what piece of this does the studio contribute? And guess what? We're all working less money, making less money on fewer episodes of TV shows, and our healthcare costs are going up, and we're screwed.
Right. So it's like, not only are you making less, but the studios are paying you less, and by paying you less, the percentage of pension and welfare, you know, the health plan
exactly.
that they pay also goes down because they're paying you less. It just kind of makes
yet
sense.
You still need the same healthcare, because if you get sick, you're still sick.
Correct. Oh, and that's getting way cheaper, he said sarcastically.
Yeah.
So that's the healthcare issue. Then you have parody. Now, here's where things get interesting, in my opinion. The Holds is interesting enough. But parody is basically, no pun intended, you had basic cable and all of these networks. Let's call them TNT, USA Network, AMC. Come along and say, look, we're not nearly as watched as, say, NBC, CBS, none of the big broadcast networks. We can't compare. We can't compete for the talent. So we'd like to pay writers 2/3 of what those big broadcast networks pay, because we don't have the viewership, and thus we can't charge, you know, enough for advertising to pay you what the big broadcast networks pay. And they said that for years, for decades, frankly. And now the writers are saying, hey, AMC, you know how you said you really didn't have the money and you didn't have the viewership? What are the most popular shows on television right now? Isn't it The Walking Dead? And wasn't before that Breaking Bad? And before that, hey, Mad Men, you're winning all these awards and you're making all this money and you keep talking about how successful you are until it comes time to pay us. So we want.
And hey, Netflix.
Right.
You're just a streaming site. We don't count. Well, you know, we can't be expected to pay money.
Right. And so there's, you know, some royalty issues there, which I'm not hearing too much about, but with the streaming, that is. But with the payment for these basic cable shows, they want parity with broadcast shows. So instead of being paid 2/3 of what broadcast shows get paid, they want full freight. That is the issue where I think there's going to be a hiccup.
So the producers, the big people said, oh, you bastards, you said it would be an easy negotiation and now it's all messy. And the writers are like, no, it can be quick. Just give us what we want.
And the producers are saying, hold on. Okay, let me just look at this. You want, Holds, healthcare, and parody. Well, we're willing to give you, of these three, nothing, actually. We're willing to give you nothing.
Right. The Writers Guild has offered to renew talks on April 10th. They have a strike vote authorized for April 19th. The TV execs, and it's a lot of this is about TV because that's where the action is and so much work is happening right now. But of course, it affects everyone. The TV execs say the WGA has no leverage, so they're saber rattling. That's what they said to some of the trades. I'm like, well, of course, what can they do except threaten to strike? That's the only saber they have to rattle. That's the only leverage they, you know, possess. Of course, that's what they, you know, what else are they going to say? So it's messy and it's big. My question is, one, do you think the strike is going to happen? And two, why was the DGA able to make a deal?
I'd have to go back and review the DGA deal, to be honest. I'd have to refresh my memory and probably should have before we began this. But I'd have to, you know, I can't answer that. So that's really where I'd have to go. And I'd have to, frankly, we should have Jonathan Handel on to discuss all of this. And you know what? I'm making a note to myself.
There's no show next week.
But I think they're going to strike. That's my feeling. I think they are so far apart on all of these issues. There's going to be a strike. It's been 10 years. The last one, I think, was 30 years. It was 87 to 2007. So 20 years. I think this time there's going to be a strike.
And what does that mean for everybody else?
Well, it means like The Daily Show, for instance. You won't be able to have The Daily Show or The Tonight Show, although they will do it. The problem is that, you know, the shows will be underwritten, so to speak. And I don't
last time the strike lasted 3 months, November 5th of 2007 to February 12th, 2008. It's about 12,000 people at the time in the WGA. So, and it affects everybody, film, TV, radio, websites. 12,000 screenwriters and TV writers in the guild were part of that strike a decade ago.
Right. And I think this time around, I don't know how long it will last. I do think that unless they get even a smidgen closer, there's going to be a strike because SAG is right around the corner. SAG and AFTRA are also negotiating with the producers this year. So that's one of the reasons the producers are so upset, because they said, well, we waited so long to start negotiating. You said it would take 2 weeks. Now we have our backs up against the wall with SAG-AFTRA. So we have no time to negotiate with you.
So just take what we give you.
Right, pretty much. That's one of their excuses. And the writers went, yeah, that's your problem, not mine.
So if you're, so it's ugly. So if you're a producer and you want to give us your point of view, by all means do, because we're obviously more aware of or empathetic, perhaps, to the Writers Guild position right now. We can hear these issues and go, yeah, that is a big problem. I don't know what the solution is other than give them more money. But, it's true. There's a lot of shows now where they have 10 or 8 episodes rather than 20 or 22. And you're still stuck waiting around for, and they're taking longer to greenlight new shows. It might be 18 months before you greenlight a show, as opposed to the cycle of the major networks where you always knew when it was going to happen and it happened or it didn't. Right. So it's just a big, messy world out there. And there's a lot of new factors and everybody's trying to get by.
Well, that's the writers for shows that, well, are either being shot now or, future shows. But there, of course, are people who have kind of helped make television what it is today. And some of them aren't around anymore, including
for
Chuck Barris.
For good or ill.
That's right. Yeah. I was waiting for you to gong me in that transition there.
Yeah, two Chucks died last week, and we missed Chuck Barris. Chuck Berry made it just under the wire, and then Chuck Barris died. He died at 87 years old. I can't believe he was 87. That freaked me out more than anything else, because he always seems, I guess, perennially youthful. But, he did the Gong Show, which helped discover and bring attention to Pee Wee Herman, Oingo Boingo, among other things, by the way. It wasn't all jokes there. The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game. He wrote a hit song, which I didn't know when I read his obit. Palisades Park, recorded by Freddie Cannon. So that's kind of crazy. It was the B-side of another song, and then a DJ in Flint, Michigan, hopefully not drinking water at the time, played it by accident, and it went all the way to number 3. Then he wrote his bio, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and my favorite bit about Chuck Barris dying was that numerous outlets felt the need to say that Chuck Barris claimed in his memoir he was a CIA assassin, and many people disputed it. It's like, people, it wasn't serious. Like, for the love of God, nobody actually thought it was a CIA assassin, you idiots. But anyway, a heck of a fixture, and whatever you think of reality TV and game shows and all that stuff has been around since the day one of television and radio. But boy, he was an iconic fixture.
Well, Chuck Barris won't be listening to us anymore.
That's right.
But we hope you continue to listen and subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us. So please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can find us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. That information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. It's also where you'll find ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. And every week, Michael Giltz has something new and exciting, another new website for us to check out. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's colorizingsucks.com.
Which I think probably is a website geared towards Turner, Ted Turner, who was colorizing old movies, and nobody
liked it. I had a magnet of a photo of Ted Turner colorized in. It was a picture of him colorized in with like green skin and yellow hair. It was very grotesque looking. It was awesome. I had it on my fridge for many, many years.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can check out all of his work on michaelgiltz.com. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until 2 weeks from now, play nice.